Ian McCune is head of athletic development at Port Adelaide Football Club in the Australian Football League. In this chat, Mackers and I talk about all of the big rock pieces in the puzzle of athletic performance. This is not your typical chat where you'll hear about GPS, Excel spreadsheets, or platitudes about culture, but some really honest chat over how a football team performs at its best week in, week out, over a long season. I hope you enjoy this chat as much as I do. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Realms podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fuss. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Athletic development at Port Adelaide Football Club in the Aussie Rules Football League. I'm pretty excited to talk to Ian today, not just about all the generic GPS and load management stuff that we always hear about in the AFL, but really a lot of what goes into the day-to-day operations making a team perform and be so successful. So welcome to the show, Mackers.
Thanks, Jake. Thanks for having me. I really love listening to your podcast, and yeah, I'm honored to be part of it.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So let's kick off and just hear a little bit about where you're at right now in your season. I know you said you're in the mid-season bye, so maybe a little bit of background on just what an AFL season calendar looks like and where your day-to-day is at right now.
Sure. So yeah, as I said, we're in the mid-season bye. We have our bye this weekend. Half the teams had it last weekend. So we're going through roughly, we split it into 12 and 10 games or weekends. So I guess one of the really fortunate things about AFL is a lot of the time we have to prepare the guys in preseason. So unlike most sports, we've got a decent amount of time. So we've between 3 and 4 months most of the time to prepare these guys. So our preseason break is our preseason period is about that long. And then we're running through. So depending on how successful you are with finals, you're sort of looking at playing games from March to end of September if you make it all the way. So it's a nice split. We do have an imposed break or an imposed off season, which is obviously it's very, very positive for our guys to get a mental refresh as well as physically. And then we are very fortunate that we do get a lot of time with our guys in preseason, which we can affect change, I guess, as well. And that's when the party really happens from us from a physical preparation point of view. But yeah, and then in seasons, it's a week to week. Either playing Saturday or Sunday. If you're lucky enough, you might get a Friday night game. And you're looking at sort of you're playing between 6, 7, and 8 day breaks. So again, comparison to some of the other sports and more popular sports around the world, you know, football, for example, you know, we get quite a lot of time between games.
Yeah, it is interesting to hear. You know, we talk a lot about load management and building athletes up to be able to withstand match demands while also building up the skills and the tactics which go into sport, which have over 30 people on the pitch. AFL is pretty unique. Now, you've been in this game for a while. I know, obviously, you've come across from Ireland and working in Australia for a long time now. I think when I look at social media and I hear people talking about their opinions on certain things in strength and conditioning, I'm wondering two things. I'm always wondering, number one, are they training athletes in outer space? And number two, do they have more hours in the day than you and I have? Because they seem to have time to focus on all sorts of minutiae, which just doesn't even enter our radar screens when we're trying to manage everything that goes into managing a group of athletes. So from the ground floor, can you tell us what's it like in the day-to-day for an elite strength and conditioning coach in a premier sport?
Yeah, I'll try and maybe if I talk you through or walk you through what a normal day, a main training day looks like for us. And I guess underpinning a lot of what we've done throughout the day is there's a lot of planning goes in behind the scenes, I guess, to make sure that everything runs very slickly. And we're not having to we have as few knee-jerk reactions as possible, so that we can just concentrate on coaching and interacting with the athletes or the players in front of us at that time. So yeah, I know when you get the ideal, or you get the people critiquing what other people do or see, I think that sometimes it's, you know, as you said, I don't know how many hours they get in a day, but I guess what they're probably focusing on isn't necessarily what I'd prioritize or what you would prioritize. And I guess it's different with each group, which you get to work with. So, you know, it is very, I can be a little bit cynical of some of the things that go out there sometimes, but I think everyone's just got to keep that in mind a little bit. So from the moment the guys walk in, on a typical training day, the guys normally roll in for a morning training session. If we do a double day, they'll come in about 8 o'clock. Between 8 o'clock and 9:30, they have to prepare for the session ahead and the team meeting. So whether that's looking at vision, getting themselves strapped, et cetera. Within that time as well, we also have a special sort of individual needs type session. So this is probably your, more people would generally term their injury prevention time. So whether it's direction from the physio, that they need to do a little bit extra of this, they need to switch this on, they need to do that, whatever. We try and do that in the morning. I tend to look at it more as a, for sure, it's a prep for the day ahead, but then it's also a reset or a recalibration. If you sort of take what Kelly Strett, who I know has talked really well about this area, and I steal quite a bit of his work. So we're trying to reset capsules. We're trying to get some neuromobility into our guys that need it. We're trying to get them to start off at least at ground zero rather than starting off further behind than where they were. Either from a preseason point of view when they're getting incredible loads placed on their body, or in season whenever they're just trying to recover from games. So one way or the other, we try and get that in there. And I think what's really interesting about this time is that session is programmed by me. So I'm the gatekeeper to that load, to steal, again, another person, to steal Dan Paff's terminology from it. But I think that what's important is, and what typically happens is that, and what is great is that everybody wants to be part of a collaborative effort to program and prepare our athletes to be the best they can be. I think what happens, though, is that we all have our own take on things. And if we all add to the pot in which the players have got to steal from, we end up taking far too much from them. And I think that a lot of it is unnecessary and can be done a little bit more intelligently. So that's typically where I try, and for sure we do everything that the physios ask of us, but we try and manipulate that either into the strength sessions or into these individual needs sessions where they can be appropriately progressed and challenged in the right way. So rather than just go and do 3 sets of 10 of this, go and do this, that, and the other, I think we try and make sure that I guess that's my responsibility, and that's where I hope my expertise lies. So hopefully we can balance that up, and that's how we get the ball rolling, and try and ensure that load isn't getting a little bit silly. Because obviously we've got guys who have lots and lots of issues. But if we can, get them back to ground zero by the time the team meeting starts, then we can try and tackle them either in training or in the strength sessions later on in the afternoon.
Because you've got that plan in place, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we typically, rather than, your injury prevention program has to have, so many exposures to adduction. It has to have so many things with single leg stability, whatever you might typically look at. But if you only have a blinkered or a very spotlighted view, I guess, of that one session, you can, it's quite ignorant of the whole program and the whole exposure that player might get throughout the day. So remember, that player is going to have that individual needs session. They'll also hopefully have a really good warm up on the field, so they're getting reinforcing. So it's not just about getting them moving and getting prepared for that session. It's about, I guess, recalibrating and getting an opportunity to teach these guys even more. They're then going to do a warm-up for their gym session. They're going to do a team session that's going to include an absolute incredible amount of work within that as well. Plus, we're incredibly lucky in that we also have, outside of our strength sessions, we'll have what we term movement sessions. And in pre-season, these are very much based around movement quality, making sure that we're getting context to our running drills, making sure that we've got a little bit more one-on-one time with these guys rather than just in the warm-up. So when you look at the whole day, so when these guys leave at 5 o'clock, if by the end of the day you can't honestly say that you have tackled all these individual things which the players need to have done, well, that's a problem. I think that the individual program, which might be that one in the morning, if you just look at that in isolation, for sure you're going to miss things out. But if you consider what they've got throughout the whole day, that's the big thing. And the whole day, then if you take it, you expand that even further throughout the whole week, making sure that they're getting things like exposure every week, every month. And then we start to see this long-term sort of drip feed of athletic development, as I like to call it. So it's not necessarily based around one session, but around many sessions. So hopefully that answers a little bit of what the expectation is of me and what we look at throughout a day. But then also, again, from a coaching load point of view. So we've got quite a few different opportunities in which we can affect change, positive change, hopefully.
Yeah, I like the way that you frame that it's kind of that dual approach of, like, you know, are they getting better with, you know, where does this fit in the puzzle, you know?
Yes.
I think that answered the question really well, because on the philosophy and big rock side of things, I'd like to really expand a bit more, please, on how you, maybe what are some keys to success on that gatekeeper role? So how do you look at not just the programming, right? Because, you know, we don't just program in a room and then it goes out and all happens magically. That would be great if it did, right? But how do you, as a gatekeeper, manage your design creative process and then the communication process with everyone on your staff and the delivery of that programming?
Yeah, and again, this is something which I'm constantly challenged with, and I'm still not very. I'm not happy with where I'm at with it. I think I can improve on this area for sure. But again, you know, the more we learn, the better we get. So I think for me, the most important thing is, I guess, the mutual respect from each profession, but then also the equal communication, equally the communication which goes with that. So as I said, you know, I try and not frame the questions to the physios or the doctors or anybody else that's involved in, or the podiatrist, for example, in terms of what can they do, what can't they do, what's the problem, and expect them to come back with an exercise prescription. What I try and get tease out of them is the movements in which the strength qualities in which they would like to see, the movement qualities which they would like to see out of the area, the contraindications of doing something, and explaining what, because what one guy knows is as simple as what someone knows is an RDL versus a deadlift. When they're not used to our world, you know, they could be prescribing a deadlift when they really meant an RDL, or, you know, like, you can get into so many confusing things. And then you add in all the stupid names and the stupid shit that we come up with, which is very individual. It adds so much confusion. So I try and stay away from, like, I don't want to know that he can do leg extension, because quite frankly, I'm going to stay as far away from leg extension as humanly possible. I'm going to try and make sure that we're doing it in some other way which challenges him athletically rather than just in a isolated movement. For sure, sometimes that those types of things have to be put into the program from a clinical point of view, and that's where I take their guidance. But again, I guess that's probably the biggest thing from the gatekeeper point of view, I guess. And to be really selfish about it, it's the best way to learn what these guys are doing. I think that we have an incredible group, and in terms of our staff and the things which I can learn are pretty cool. So, like, I don't just want to be satisfied with them just programming. I want to learn much more. So I think this is a good way for me to do it. And again, then it means that we're very collaborative with our approach. So again, you know, I must stress, like, I would never go against what anyone's saying, but we try and make sure that we collaborate and make sure that everybody's satisfied with what goes into the program eventually. And again, that involves very transparent programming, that involves very transparent communication of what every player is doing, and being very open to, you know, I know that in some places and some organizations, there's a lot of friction between physios and strength and conditioning, and lots of egos and lots of territory involved. To be honest, that the more our physios spend in the gym, the better. Mm. And the more they understand. And again, same for me, the more time I can spend in with them when they're treating, the more I get to understand what they need from the player, and how they feel that they can improve.
I think Port are pretty lucky that they have someone, and I'm sure multiple people who are you know, of such a growth mindset that they want to learn from the other departments and mix it up so much. Because, you know, what you're saying makes me think about, I find it fascinating, Matt, because it's like, you know, who's responsible for exercise prescription and load prescription and load delivery? I mean, it's, you know, it's absolutely the head coach's prerogative to sprint the hell out of his athletes. But, you know, that's is that his responsibility? Is that his, you know, is that his burden? Because then we have to come back and manage that. And so do the physios. And I mean, I wouldn't want to think what percentage of teams around the world do not manage that at all and just kind of go by the seat of their pants. It's a little bit scary, I think, a bit of an elephant in the room. Can you maybe expand just a tiny bit on how you work those communication channels from a global perspective?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're incredibly lucky at Port, and I guess in the AFL in general, that high performance manager role is quite well evolved now, mm-hmm. in that these guys are, so with Darren Burgess, you know, he's one of the best in the world, or if not the best, in terms of that communication with the coaches and that management of letting the coaches get what they want from a technical point of view and tactical point of view, but then also making sure that the global load ensures that they're continually in a state of readiness or a state of fitness, or where we're trying to get them as fit as possible. And then that leaves me then to manage that load or mirror that load and complement what they're doing out on the field, and making sure that we're not, you know, because yeah, we can do a hell of a lot of damage if we really wanted to, in terms of that load and overtraining, or, you know, just that generally that fatigue balance in which they live in, we can really do some damage there. So we try and make sure that we don't. And I guess, yeah, look, that communication and being part of the coaching team, I guess, is really important. And that's one of the things that Berger does incredibly well, is making sure that the coaches feel like they're getting and satisfying that what they need, but then we're also getting it from a protective point of view as well, from the pure brutality of it. We're making sure that we're ready for the games, never mind from a performance improvement point of view, just making sure that shit, these guys can actually handle what they've got to.
Being robust is pretty important, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, that's the, you know, I guess if you're talking about philosophies or KPIs or what I feel that our job is to do, I think that the biggest thing is to make sure that we have a healthy list. Never mind all this sexy stuff and terminology around athleticism and strength and fitness, etc. I think what we really have to make sure is that first and foremost we have a healthy list, and everything else comes from that.
And just to track back a little bit, what's the process like? What's the benign, actionable process, Mac, is on how you ensure that all the staff around you are delivering the programming which yourself and Darren Burgess just put together? So simply, like, do you have a meeting at the start of every day or every week with your assistants and with the other SNCs and all those guys on what the mission is and how they're going to deliver and all that stuff? What's that look like?
Yeah, I guess this is something which we're constantly exploring and constantly changing, I guess. For me, I guess the program is my blueprint. So I'll put together the blueprint, and the framework, I guess, which I expect everyone to work within. So our assistant coaches to work within, and they do a phenomenal job of satisfying that, but then also learning and complementing what we're doing as well. I think that that's probably the biggest thing for me, and we'll do that. I don't know. I'm not very much a dictator. I'm very much about leading and just and showing by example. So what we'll do is we'll have a meeting at the start of the year where we set out our non-negotiables in terms of behaviors and what we expect. And then if we're living up to our expectations, we shouldn't have to discuss that again. What happens from that though is that I expect creativity and I expect a little bit of feed forward or a little bit of proactivity in terms of how the programs are delivered, and alongside that then continual learning. So our guys are relatively junior that are working with us at the moment, but what they're able to do is have the safety net of the blueprint or the framework in which we've put in place, but then, you know, like I don't feel there's no right or wrong exercise in the world. There's no right or wrong progression in the world. I think that you can go whatever way you want. But I think that there's obviously a sort of a roadmap in which we want to go down. And I think that it's not right for anyone to enforce that, well, you've got to go from, say a reverse lunge into a forward lunge. Like, Christ, you could go from a reverse lunge into a step up into whatever the hell you want. Like, for me, it's that I don't need to get into the particulars of that. I feel that you need to make the right, you have to evolve that process as you go. And I think that if you're just being told how to coach and what you're supposed to coach, and this is the progression, I feel that you're losing out on the big part of what we're doing and the creativity and the imagination and the living the program is typically what I like. I think if you want to coach really well, you have to have lived the program in your head. You have to have a real like every program that you write should be exciting you, and that you ain't going to deliver this. It's going to be freaking awesome because it's got this, this, and this. And I can sort of envisage in my head how I'm going to coach this or my attitude or my. I think that that only comes from the organic process. So by being told to paint by numbers, it's a little bit bullshit. And obviously, as you learn, you've got to have a safety net there so you don't do anything wrong. But I think that what we do wrong, you know, we all do something wrong. So I guess it's just making sure that they have that. And hopefully, you know, you speak to these guys about it, but hopefully they find that accelerates their growth from a coaching point of view, but also my go-to word at the moment is it ignites what they feel is important as a coach rather than being told. I don't feel it. I feel that the really, really good people in the world, and good people, I don't mean good coaches or technically good S&C coaches or the people who tell themselves that they're good coaches on Twitter, the people who are really good, they have that ignition or they have that feeling. And I want to grow that, I guess, with my staff. So that's hopefully, yeah, that's typically what we do. So it's not we'll meet a lot and we'll talk shit a lot and we will do things a lot. And I will challenge them every sporadically. You know, what do you want to get better at? What am I not giving you? What do you need to get better at? Are you happy taking this session? These types of things, like we will build that. But again, it's probably deliberate in my head or deliberate ploy from my point of view, but we try and keep it, as a creative environment as possible. I guess working in, and this is probably one of the things, one of the points around the real world versus, theory is that, you can't set a meeting in professional sport and expect it to happen at exactly that time every week.
That's right.
There's always changes. There's expectations on certain people within that group that maybe have to miss it. So you can't, you know, nothing's set in stone. So I guess that's a big thing. And if you come from a very bureaucratic or institutionalized environment, that's quite a challenge, because you could go a week without speaking to somebody whenever, you know, you usually have these weekly meetings with the service providers or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just can't afford that time. So I think that's a pretty cool thing. And I guess that means you have to be really on your game in terms of your communication and your transparency as well.
That's really interesting the way you frame that at the end, because I think that's, I have to be careful here, but that's something which is quite endemic across different cultures that you'll see. Like, I'd actually argue in a place like Germany or even Holland, those meetings do happen exactly when they say they will, most of the time. But in places like that, I'll risk it and go ahead and say they're not very creative with programming, and there's not a whole lot of different ways that things are done around the country. They probably have a couple of systems which they've shown have worked, and that's the methodology, and it's very tightly organized, and it's beautiful, but that's the way it is. Whereas, you know, somewhere like in Australasia, there's a little bit more creative license, and therefore more ideas produced. And even then, I think the relationship aspect, you know, maybe it's geographical, but I don't know if you'd see in Germany, like, you know, the head coach and the intern going surfing together all the time and that being a normal thing, you know? So it's just, it's different in different places. But I think it's really interesting what you said there, the whole paint by numbers thing, because I noticed that, there's a lot of places around this world where there are in great, you know, prestigious, high ticket organizations, assistants, or even interns who are not necessarily more useful to this field than in much different places because they are just paint by numbers. They've learned in that gig a bunch of new exercises and how to cue them. They've had exposure to higher level athletes. They've got cool kit or whatever, but are they empowered to progress and regress? Are they empowered to figure it out on the fly, or are they just, we're going to do it this way because this is how boss says to do it, and we'll hope for the best and ask a question later rather than I got this, you know. And that doesn't happen overnight. Obviously, it doesn't turn into that right off the bat. But I think it's pretty darn cool that you have that initiative to do things that way.
Yeah, and look, to be honest, like, I think that there's definite positives to doing it that way, particularly if you're working with a lot of different people and you're maybe working with very inexperienced coaches. I absolutely think that you have to cut your teeth and you have to understand.
Sure.
And sometimes to not have to worry about programming and just have to worry about what's in front of you is a very important thing. However, I just feel that because there's maybe five of us and there's 40 athletes, you know, and we're in one small space at one time, they're not going to do anything silly while I'm around, you know, to help them out. So, you know, they've always got the immediate, they can always just, you know, pull the parachute and ask the question straight away. Like there's no stress with that. And actually I'd much prefer them to challenge and ask those questions as we go as well. So like, yeah, absolutely. There's right ways. There's a million ways to, you know, skin a cat. But I guess just for this environment at this time, it sticks out that this is probably, well, hopefully the best way to do it.
That's a good way of framing it and finding that balance, isn't it? So Ian, a lot of different organizations around the world, but especially those in Australasia and the United Kingdom as well, are implementing research as part of their programs. And a lot of great organizations have students attached, you know, to kind of cheap labor, but also validating in-house methods can be extremely valuable. Obviously, I have a PhD student in a high-performance program as well, so I'm going to back this. But I think the reaction which we saw to Martin Bouchet's 0.2 difference publication a few months back, that was like a 2015 Bernie Sanders rally. The reaction on Twitter, everyone was just going, that shit, I loved it. And so tell us a bit about how you integrate research at Port Adelaide and the value and what it brings to the table.
Yeah, look, I think it's quite an interesting one for us. In particular, we've got quite a strong partnership with UniSA and our group, our coaching group, or sorry, our performance team are either doing PhDs or have got PhDs at the moment. I think first and foremost is that if there's we're working in professional sport and we're incredibly privileged to be working in AFL, which is arguably one of the premier environment in which we can actually make some changes in. So I think by taking that responsibility and taking a bit of pride in that, I think you've got to make sure that what you're doing is the best practice. And I think that underpinning absolutely everything that you do, you've got to have, if there's science there to underpin it, you've got to have it there. And if we want to show that we're making changes and we're not just basing that upon some arbitrary units, we have to understand what are those changes? What are we actually making? So across the whole board, I feel that if you take away from research and we just understand what science is and the questions in which rather than talking about increases in 1 RM increase, just making sure that they're strong enough. Like, let's get beyond that. Let's talk about, are we actually making some true differences across the board? I feel that we should be able to do that. It's our responsibility to do that. And then from that, then you've got research. And I guess we're doing small plots of research every day. And training interventions is probably something which we can't do because of the environment in which we live in. But I think that it's important for us to describe the changes in which we do make, and describe the incredible human, you know, performance feats that these guys have to deal with. And we have to be able, if we want to sit in a room with the best in the world in their individual area. So if you want to talk to Martin Bouchard, if you want to talk to Dan Baker, you want to talk to Greg Kraft, Craig Purdom, anyone around the world around these particular areas, you have to back it up with strong science. And it's probably one of the things which I don't want to get caught out with. I want to make sure that if someone's going to challenge me on my programming and what we're doing within in our environment, well, we're going to whack them out of the park with not only the passion and the coaching and the art of what we do, but we're actually going to do it with the science of what we do as well. So I'm a little bit fed up, to be honest, with we're only S&C coaches. It's all about the art. It's all about interacting. What do these scientists know about interacting with our athletes? That's a shit excuse for me. I think that for sure that's something which these guys will never know. But I don't think we can just lower ourselves to then say, oh, well, they don't know what they're talking about. I think we need to be able to attack and be able to argue at that level as well. And that's a little bit of my motivation for making sure that what we're doing is true. So, for example, our research at the moment at Port Adelaide in one particular area is around athletic development. So it's, what the hell does it actually mean? What are the changes in which we can typically make with an AFL team? And then seeing it, does it actually make a difference? Does it discriminate between the good and the bad and the ugly? Does it? And then, therefore, what are the changes which we can make? Because in strength and conditioning, we all talk about, oh, well, you've got to be able to move well. You've got to have the fundamentals. You've got to have this. You've got to have this underpinning movement ability or vocabulary of movements before you can start to add strength, add load, add complexity. But where's the evidence behind that? Whereas there's evidence behind, well, if you get stronger, you get faster. You know, that's out there. It's been out there for 20, 30 years that this information is out there. But there's a massive disconnect between strength science and performance science. And I feel that this is one thing which athletic development is the gray area in between. And that's something which I've put my hand up to try and explain or explore that it's, and I guess reverse engineer the evidence behind what good people do. Like, you know, Nick Gill doesn't go out and just do strength with the All Blacks. You know, you don't get guys like, you know, Dan Baker doesn't do that with the Broncos, or didn't do that with the Broncos. You don't get Dean Benton doing that stuff. You know, they all have this underpinning knowledge. And rather than just having this experiential evidence, which doesn't sit well whenever you're dealing with people who are in the academia, I feel like if we want to join these areas up and we want to marry these, I think that we have to be able to step up a little bit as well, and I guess that's something which we're trying to do as a group, and something which I've probably I'm stuck in now, and it will probably be a lifetime's work trying to make sure that we are making sure that what we are doing is best practiced, and it's got some evidence behind it as well.
I think. That one day we're going to look back and kind of giggle and say, wow, you know, this field existed for 30, 40 years before we even had any kind of picture painted on what an athlete even looked like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's something which we have to explore and we have to describe as accurately as possibly. So, you know, this is probably one small step in the whole phase, but I think it's important that we try and redirect some of our energy into that area.
Well, and I think we're really lucky, you know, in today's era, you know, social media and open communication, that you know, if you get one person over here, one person over there, one person over there, working to build towards this consensus, and you know, just another brick in the wall, that we will make something happen. I think that's pretty exciting. Ian McEwen, thank you so much for your time. That is a lot of wisdom. I'm excited already for the next time we chat on a whole list of topics we'll have to yarn over.
Brent, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Check back soon for part two with Mackers and an exciting chat with Franz Bosch. If you leave a review of this podcast on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me and a big high five. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.